There are some changes from the 2010, but the latest version is the 2010, and there are some updates for the proposed 2012 implementation procedures. So I'll give you a little background information about the what we call the IPs, implementation procedures. One of the major changes is whole effluent toxicity, or wet testing, and dechlorination. And the narrative nutrient criteria has not changed much from the 2010, or actually not changed at all from the 2010 IPs. And then talk about some of the recommendations for the next IPs. So the existing IPs that we're using were issued in 2003. In 2010, there was a version that was approved in June by our commissioners. It was sent to EPA, and EPA denied that version, and it was based mainly based on the whole effluent toxicity testing. They didn't agree with what we had in our IPs for that. The 2012 IPs were sent to commissioners' agenda, first proposed, and they'll be coming back to the commissioners' agenda in sometime in June for approval. So we've received some response to comments for these IPs, and we're making some changes based on that. We'll address those comments. And like I said, it's going to that date is actually incorrect. It'll be more like it's been pushed back to June at this point for commissioner's agenda. And then it'll go to EPA for a review, and hopefully they'll like the changes that we've made from the 2010 version. As far as wet testing, the TCEQ guru for that is Michael Feil. He's on our standards implementation team, and if any of you all have had to deal with wet testing issues, I'm sure you've spoken with him and probably know him well. A little background on the wet testing. EPA issued draft guidance in 2004, and that was to get some national consistency and try to get a little more consistency throughout the programs. In 2006, EPA region, 2005, EPA region 6 came up with sublethal reasonable potential determinations, RP determinations, which mean that not only are you busting or not passing a test if you're killing these surrogate organisms for this biomonitoring. And the surrogate organisms are things like water fleas, fathead minnows, thank you. I wanted to say stone roller. I always wanted to say that. Fathead minnows, and then there's some different species for saltwater. So if not only would you be not passing a test if you killed an organism in your in some of your dilutions, if you're having lower reproduction or growth, then that could also be considered not passing. So that's the sublethal determinations that EPA was talking about in 2005. So the purpose of the wet testing, let me stick with my slides here. I kind of already mentioned this. They require reasonable potential. Okay, reasonable potential determination is to determine if there is reasonable potential for the effluent to cause toxicity in the waters that they're receiving. And so that's why EPA came up with these reasonable potential tests to have some endpoints that are a little more refined than just the lethal endpoints. So as I mentioned, growth and reproduction are some of the endpoints. Historically, we haven't required these, but TCEQ was requiring toxicity reduction evaluations, or TREs, if people were finding some mortality in their tests. They would be required to perform a TRE to try to trace down what chemical is causing that, so that the industry can, or municipality can target that, set some limits for that particular toxic element, and not have to go into wet testing. And if they can avoid going into whole effluent toxicity testing, the applicant is definitely going to want to go that route. So that's where EPA objected to our 2010 IPs, was our lack of reasonable potential determinations for the wet testing. So our approach was to use basically a matrix or a reasonable potential tree. So if you have three or more failures within the past 5 years, or three failures with two in the past 3 years, that equals reasonable potential. Or one or more failures in the past 5 years, but less than the above, that requires a best professional judgment approach. That uses a weight of evidence approach to try to determine, okay, you had some testing failures, but it does take into account certain things, like if there was construction or some treatment upgrades, maybe you had some mortality in the early testing, but you've done some treatment upgrades and have not had mortality since, then using best professional judgment, we'd say, well, okay, you don't really have reasonable potential to cause toxicity there, that kind of gives a little bit of a break. So toxicity reduction evaluations, they were required, but they're no longer required. The EPA does not require these TREs, but TCEQ still strongly recommends them. As I mentioned, if you perform a TRE, can determine which toxicant is causing the problem, then the applicant will definitely want to take some measures to reduce those toxicants and not have to go into wet testing.
How do you do that?
It depends on any number of things. It can be analyzing the effluent for individual metals or you know, whatever your system might be. If it's an industry, you know, if you're using organic processes, you look at the organics and see if there's something that's higher than others, you know, put some processes in there to reduce that amount. And if you are not having lethality in your biomonitoring after that, then you know that, okay, that was the one that was causing it.
I was afraid we were going to have to do autopsies on the fish.
No. These water fleas are pretty small. It's hard to get a scalpel that far. I'm sure it can be done, though. I'm sure people have done that somehow. There's probably some thesis projects there. Okay, for compliance period, TCEQ has a default 3-year compliance period. EPA objected to that. They said, no, let's go with 34 months.
2 months.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, kind of car dealing at that point, maybe, but used car dealing. It can be difficult to complete a TRE within the even 34 months. So, you know, if a TRE is going to be performed, it needs to be really well planned out. As far as enforcement of whole effluent toxicity, EPA objected. The EPA wants one failure to be considered an enforcement issue. If you have one failure, then it'll go into testing. TCEQ disagrees with this. In fact, EPA has a paper titled "A Review of Single Species Toxicity Tests: Are the Tests Reliable Predictors of Aquatic Ecosystem Community Response?" And that paper, which was an EPA paper, found that one test is not characteristic of a violation of effluent permit limits. So there's a little bit of contradiction there, but nonetheless, that's what EPA is pushing right now. As far as wet limit removal, we have, I say we, Michael File has determined that 10 data points are scientifically justifiable for the removal of wet limits. EPA disagrees with this. So that's another one of the kind of sticking points on the whole revision of the IPs. So to summarize the change in the IPs for the whole effluent toxicity testing, EPA denied approval of the 2010 IPs due to the wet regional reasonable potential. TCEQ proposed changed IPs for the 2012 to address these objections, and our 2012 IPs outline the method for this reasonable potential determination. And these IPs are scheduled for adoption in June, and following that, scheduled for adoption by TCEQ commissioners, and then followed by that, it'll go to EPA for their review. So one of the other changes from our 2010 implementation procedures is dechlorination. Before, we were requiring dechlorination for anything greater than 1 million gallons per day. EPA objected to this, and so we are proposing for anything from 0.5 to 1 MGD. For the lower, well, I guess 0.5 and above would require dechlorination. That is for new and expanding permits.
What's required now?
No dechlorination is required for 0.5 to 1 MGD or less than 1 MGD. But greater than 1 MGD right now, it is required.
Okay.
So that's the change there.
Okay.
So chlorine can be effective at reducing or eliminating bacteria if there is a 1 to 4 milligram per liter residual chlorine for at least 20 minutes in the contact chamber. But it can be toxic to aquatic life. It's been found to be toxic to aquatic life at very small, much smaller concentrations. So that's the reasoning behind the dechlorination. there is going to be a phased approach to dechlorination. Well, I'll get to that on the next slide. So there are some implementation challenges to this. Anytime we require some upgrades or changes, somebody's got to pay for that. There are operational and management decisions that have to be made, and there could be some health, safety, and environmental concerns whenever changes are made to a plant. And so this phased approach, as I mentioned, we're going to require dechlorination for anything from 0.5 milligrams per liter to 0.5 MGD to 1 MGD for new and amended permits, in addition to the currently required 1 MGD and greater. But pretty soon, in the phase two of this phased approach, we're going to require that even when permits are renewed, that they're going to have to go along with this dechlorination requirement. And this is basically, and EPA seems to agree that these smaller facilities aren't doing as much damage as the bigger ones, so we can kind of phase them in and don't have to just hit them all at the same time. So the major revisions in these IPs are an effort to get agreement from EPA to their original objections. There are some minor corrections, just typos or just minor corrections that need to be made. There are some changes to minimum analytical levels, and the date for compliance to those has been extended. So nutrients, Jill spoke about this. Jill Sickets spoke about this earlier today. So some of this is going to be a little bit of a review. And so I'll kind of try to speed through that a little bit so we're not wasting time. But right now we are basically enforcing or requiring nutrient limits in permits based on our narrative criteria, because the numeric criteria have not really developed yet. It's been slower to develop, as Jill was saying. And these are for all our water bodies, really. And Jill mentioned this earlier. We want to control nutrients just to reduce the amount of excessive algae that might be growing in these water bodies that are more susceptible to nutrient enrichment. The more turbid water bodies or water bodies that have a heavy canopy cover and are deeper, they're not quite as sensitive to nutrients, and so we're not going to be looking for nutrient limits on those as much as the shallow, clear hill country type streams that are a lot more susceptible to nutrient enrichment. So our rules state that nutrients shall not cause excessive growth of aquatic vegetation which impair the existing, attainable, or designated use. To what we look at for these, we use these screening factors when determining whether a permit needs limits or not. And for reservoirs, we're looking at the size of the discharge, the distance from the outfall to the reservoir, sensitivity, as I mentioned, water clarity, is it more sensitive to vegetation? Are we observing vegetation increases when some sort of nutrient enrichment occurs? What is our consistency with other permits? Do other permits discharging to this reservoir have permit limits or not? And also we're looking at local dispersion, mixing, and impacts on the main pool. So I kind of mentioned this screening factor for water clarity, also canopy cover. If say there's a transition zone that goes into the reservoir, if there's a lot of canopy cover that reduces the amount of light penetration, then that will be a little less susceptible to these nutrient enrichments. And as turbidity increases, the need for nutrient limits decrease. For streams, some of the same factors, such as the size of discharge, but some different factors, such as in-stream dilution. Is this a small treatment plant that's discharging to something the size of the Mississippi River? Well, it's probably not going to have a big impact. You know, we don't have anything like the Mississippi River coming through here, so... But we do take into consideration the size of the stream, the amount of stream flow, as I mentioned earlier, depth and water clarity, observations. Are there cases of enrichment causing actual, do we see this aquatic vegetation growing when we have enrichment coming from somewhere? Stream flow sustainability, is this something that goes dry in the summertime? Or is it flowing year-round? Is this a stream that has pools, large pools, or impoundments on it? We're going to want to be protective of those. And again, consistency with other permits. And this is just kind of a rough example of permit limits that just basically shows you that as the amount of flow from a permittee increases, the limit might go down on the as far as it might be more stringent as far as the nutrient limit is concerned. I guess I should take some time here to mention that the nutrient we're looking at for freshwater is phosphorus. That's typically the limiting nutrient for freshwater. In saltwater areas, we're looking more at nitrogen. And I'll talk about saltwater here in a minute. But we do look at these on a case-by-case basis. So you might have a small discharger that's discharging to a particularly sensitive stream, and they might be looking at more stringent limits than just a one. And here we are, nitrogen limits. As I mentioned, we look at nitrogen for bays and estuaries, and we are doing this to be protective of seagrasses. We look at things like tidal flushing, prevailing winds. Is this an area that's going to get a lot of flushing and not stagnate with the nutrients? Are those nutrients going to disperse and not cause local problems? What's the proximity to the seagrasses? And again, we're using best professional judgment here. We don't have numeric criteria for the bays and estuaries yet, so it is a best professional judgment considering those things I just mentioned. And here's an example of some of the permits that we have. For total phosphorus, we've got 6 permits at greater than 1 milligram per liter, 39 at 1. We've got 7 at 0.5, and we've got a couple more in-house at 0.5 that haven't been issued yet. And then we have 1 at 0.15 milligrams per liter total phosphorus. So that's getting down there. For total nitrogen, we have 3 total permits with nitrogen limits. 2 of those are at 6. 1 of those is at 8. I mentioned that the nitrogen limits are for estuarine areas, but one of those limits there, one of those 6 milligrams per liter is actually in freshwater, and that came about from a hearing. There was a hearing protesting this permit, and they entered into an agreement, and that 0.15 and the 6, kind of some of that came out of the hearing, although there were recommendations from our standards implementation team for very stringent nutrient limits for that permit.
Why is a small number of them that are permitted or are required to meet those limits? Those are new permits or recently construction?
Yeah, new permits for nutrient limits were more often than not looking at either new permits, amended permits, but not, we don't typically look at the renewal permits unless there's something that's a particular problem that's obvious. Okay, this was mentioned earlier, the 75 reservoirs with numeric criteria, but that's kind of still those nutrient permit requirements are coming about through the narrative criteria. We screen these permits based on the narrative criteria right now, not using the numeric criteria. So for the implementation procedures, the main contact is my boss. That's David Galindo. He's on the standards implementation team, and there's his contact information. Or you can always contact me if you have any questions. Let me see. Okay, that's what I've got. So I will entertain any questions you might have. Thanks for staying awake. Yes. That's a good question, and as far as I can remember, I don't know of any that are seasonal. I don't think we do have any seasonal nutrient limits, but it's not something that we wouldn't consider. Yes?
I was a little bit confused. We were talking about the narrative criteria. The narrative criteria apply to the receiving stream, and the numeric criteria that you're seeing, like the 0.5, that applies to your effluent limits?
No, I'm sorry. The numeric criteria, the numeric permit limit that we get, that 0.5, that is derived from the narrative criteria. So we have narrative criteria that state that indicate that, okay, we need to protect these waters, but we don't have a numeric criteria that says, okay, all these waters need to be a 0.5 or something like that. So it's the actual number that we come up with is based on, you know, we look at a number of factors. We'll look at, we can look at SWCM IS data, data on the streams that's available. But, I mean, we know that the in-stream levels of total phosphorus is going to be very low. So, really, the number that we come up with, that 0.5 or the 1, the number that the permittee gets is based on really the best professional judgment going through those screening factors and saying, okay, this is a very sensitive stream. This stream is not quite as sensitive but needs nutrient limits. But we don't have a calculation that we can run and say, okay, this gets, you know, this particular number.
Okay. When you were talking there at the last, you said something about renewals not being evaluated the same way as new applications.
Right. Typically, if a permittee is coming in for a renewal, they're not doing upgrades. They're not. They don't have funding necessarily set aside to do upgrades, and so we don't. You know, first of all, that would be a burden on the applicant that they're not necessarily expecting. Also, we have anti-degradation requirements that we have to do an anti-degradation review on any permit action that increases loading to a segment, and renewals don't increase loading to a segment, and so we don't have to do the anti-degradation review, which sometimes leads to phosphorus limits, nutrient limits.
Back to dechlorination, has there ever been studies on how far the effluent, if it's still chlorinated, is dangerous to the aquatic life before it dilutes?
I'm sure there have. I can't name any off the top of my head, but there are a lot of factors there that are involved, you know, the size of the receiving water stream, you know, the stream flow, the water body, things like that.
Right.
So I couldn't really tell you. But it depends on, could affect for some distance downstream, depending on how quickly that chlorine breaks down.
Sometimes effluent isn't even diluted on streams that are intermittent and things like that. It's more effluent dominated,
I would say if it's a moving stream, that probably 2 feet beyond the effluent pipe. But if it's a stream that's not running all the time, I accept it's going to sit there for a while.
I've seen an outfall where all the green vegetation is white for a short distance downstream just because it's bleached out.
Right. That helps on your nutrient management.
The term best professional judgment.
Yes.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, that's a difficult thing to nail down, and I realize it's difficult for permittees that wonder if they're going to be getting nutrient limits. First of all, they wonder if they might get that limit, and secondly, they would like to be able to run it through a calculation and say, okay, this is probably the limit I'm going to get, and we're just not there right now. That's where numeric criteria might, you know, it would solve some of those problems, but if you just go with a blanket, you know, okay, everybody in this stream gets a 0.5 or something like that, that might not be fair to all the dischargers. Some of the smaller dischargers might be taking a hit for what some of the larger dischargers are doing. But as I was mentioning, the best professional judgment we use are those screening factors, just looking at all those number of factors. And we actually have a sort of a point system which, you know, you go through, okay, is this sensitive to light? You know, is there a canopy cover? Is there low, medium, or heavy canopy cover? And you get a score of 1, 3, or 5, something like that. And you go through for all those different screening factors and divide by the number, and you can come up with a number that says, yes, a permit limit is needed, no, a permit limit is not needed. And then, of course, there's always the gray area where a permit limit may be needed. But as far as what that number is, it just depends on the sensitivity of the stream. And that's where the best professional judgment comes in.
Does the point source contributor have a say in that process at all?
Sure, we will always we're always happy to meet with permittees and talk about possible solutions. We do have to uphold that anti-degradation rule, and we can't issue a permit that we think is going to violate water quality standards and possibly end us up in a lawsuit. But we can definitely entertain any ideas and offer some ideas. It might be possible to discharge in another stream nearby if there's a access to piping or something like that, right of ways, or as mentioned earlier, seasonal permit limits. Anything we are able to entertain and put into an enforceable permit, and you know, we understand that money is not growing on trees when it comes to adding these treatment units.
Would you say that excuse me, would you say that a major discharger into a effluent-dominated stream is likely to have some type of phosphorus limit?
It depends. In the Houston area, probably not. In Central Texas, maybe so.
Yes.
Yeah. And the city of Georgetown has actually entered into sort of a almost a trading situation where some plants have less stringent limits, other plants have more stringent limits to try to work at it in a load type basis where, you know, the whole load coming down that stream is not not exceeding a certain number.
Are aware of it, and one of the things that has caught us in the past is the way that limits are defined is a statistically significant
determination
difference from the control,
yeah.
And that includes growing too much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to Mike File if you want to know anything about wet testing. He's the man. All right, thank you.